At the most, from the last service mission, which was what, a year or two ago, for Hubble. So if you can get seven years, or even 8 or 9 years out of Hubble, you won't have any gap between this and James Webb. The whole, maybe that thing will quit around 2018, and James Webb could go up at that time. That would be an ideal situation for me.
I was reading with reference, I changed subject a little bit now, with reference to the ultra deep field photograph that was done by the Hubble Space Telescope, which represents roughly 1 million seconds, roughly 10 days of continuous operation, something like 800, or I think it was the number of individual exposures, or was it 8,000, have they all got properly combined, and some of those extremely, extremely far galaxies that they saw were giving them an amount of light that represented one photon per minute. And the extremely deep field, ultra deep field picture has in the picture, because they chose the direction away from the center of our galaxy, it only has a couple of nearby stars in it that represent our galaxy. The other things that are in the picture, almost every single object in that picture is a galaxy. And there's 10,000 of them. 10,000 galaxies in a direction of dark space where they expected to see almost nothing. Let me drop. And the range of those pictures goes out to approximately 13 billion light years. The total observable universe has a radius of 13.77 billion light years in distance. And this thing went out to a range of roughly 13 billion light years. So some of the objects you're seeing there are were giving off light when the universe was only a couple of tenths, a few tenths of a billion light years old, 10 billion years old. The Earth had not yet been formed. The solar system wasn't yet formed when the light left some of those objects 13 billion years ago. Earth is only 4.5 billion years old. Sun, I think, is considered about 5 billion years old. But 13 billion years ago, some of those photons left some of those quasi-stellar objects and galaxies that are on that picture. And now the next question is, if that picture contains 10,000, or was it 100,000? I think it's 10,000. 10,000 galaxies. And how much of the star, how much of the sky does that cover? It covers an amount of sky that is equivalent to looking down an 8-foot-long soda straw. Take a soda straw, make it 8 feet long. That amount of sky was pictured in the ultra-deep field, and that little bit of sky, an 8-foot length of soda straw, has 10,000 galaxies. Okay? Let's assume now that I had the time and the resources to take a picture in the same manner of the whole sky. How many of those pictures would I have to take? Let me drop. And the answer is 10 million of them. So 1/10 millionth of the sky was pictured, and it contains 10,000 galaxies. You put that all together, and yes, you reconfirm the fact that there is a 10 to the 11 galaxies in the universe, in the observable universe. Makes you feel a little bit small when you see all that. So when James Webb, can you imagine when James Webb, with his got it, let me think now, 94 inches is diameter of the Hubble Space Telescope mirror. James Webb, I think, is 2.6 meters in diameter. Let's see now, that's something like 18 feet in diameter, if I understand correctly. In other words, it's approaching the size of Mount Palomar, but mounted in space. Can you imagine when that machine takes an ultra-deep field picture, what it's going to see? WS2N, what do you think that picture is going to look like, Paul, KQIW.
Oh, that would be great. Well, I thought what the comparison would be like another 15% further. I mean, really right to the beginning. I think you have like 100,000 years left, before the Big Bang. So, they showed a comparison to how far they could see. It was a graph thing that you're looking at, and James Webb exceeded Hubble probably about, I'm guessing about 15% further. They use the deep field there as a as an example, right near the Big Dipper, when two of the saws, and they did one spielman, they did the other. And, we got another question. Your question was, I answered that, 2018. I know what it was. The diameter. The diameter is, if you convert it, they always use meters. But if you use the in feet, it was 21 and a half feet is the diameter. You drop it. So you've got each piece, each hexagon shape, piece of this mirror. When you look at the work is working on these things, it's unbelievable. I mean, it does look like a. Each section looks like a 3-foot piece that they're handling, and you realize there's going to be 36 of these things. And of course, the middle one is missing. They don't have one in the middle because the light goes, it bounces off this mirror and it goes into it's a reflector built into it. And that light goes back down through the center of this whole contraption and into the detector mounted behind this gigantic mirror there.
And you may have seen that detector contains a whole lot of little micro windows, zillions and zillions of them. In other words, the individual windows that can open in that detector across that focal plane is such that they will be able to take pictures in the presence of some very strong stars. So they're going to take spectrographic pictures, and the very strong stars that are nearby would be overloading the detector, and so you just open or close those little windows to negate those particular ones and only get the ones you're looking for. I may be using the wrong words, but I wonder if you've seen that micro window detector focal plane array. Over to you, Paul.
I remember looking at it and looking at the little windows that they had, but haven't studied it that deeply. What's good is that, all these telescopes, Hubble included, has the ability with the spectroscope that they have on board to convert it into, they could see not only what these galaxies are made of, but you could tell how far away they are. When they reproduce them, the picture, look on the, I don't know what site that was, if you put in the three-dimensional view of the deep field for Hubble. They'll take you like you're on a spaceship going all the way out. Because what happens is they know how far, in the picture, these 10,000 galaxies, they know relative distances between all of them. And so, computer technology, it looks like you're flying all the way out to the end of it. And you'll be able to do the same thing with James Webb when they develop that. So, another thing I want to mention when we talk about James Webb, one of the, it's so big, like the size of an airplane, like a jet airplane. Jet airplane, it's big. We were talking about the possibility of solar wind on the ground. This thing, it's kind of hard to believe, but it's a 7-ton thing. But over time, solar wind will affect this, light waves. Not particles, not cosmic waves or anything, but the light waves will be hitting the back of the James Webb, and it will tend to move it in space. To compensate for that, they have this panel coming off. It looks like a solar panel. I can't judge the size of it, but this thing is built, it's almost like a wing, and it's movable, and they'll be able to use this thing to compensate for any kind of solar, wind that's bouncing off the James Webb telescope. I did notice that last week, reading about it. And to get back to all the different, what you were talking about before with all the different radiation and, for radio waves, you look at this, you have a spectrum from one end the other, from zero all the way up, and you drop it. You see on the thing radio waves and microwaves, then you get to the section of light on the spectrum, You know, and they change the, they can change from frequency to wavelength in their numbers when you look at a chart like that. But you can tell that, that, you know, as you're going up higher and higher, you, you pass light, you get to ultraviolet. By the way, it's amazing that light is only a small part of the whole spectrum. Like, you get into ultraviolet, and it's like, I don't know, it looks like four or five times wider than the regular light. And then you keep going all the way up, and you get to, the last one is X-rays and then gamma rays. Gamma rays, they showed that the wavelength is shorter than an atom. But all the way through, you know, from bottom to top, they don't talk about anything of it like, cosmic radiation, nuclear. Where's the nuclear part of this spectrum? None of it's there, Dick, so... If anybody ever wanted to look for it, let me drop it. You could look up anywhere on a computer or books. You look at the whole spectrum, and I guarantee you're not going to find anything that says the cosmic wave section, you know, of all these electromagnetic waves or the nuclear section, you know. So, or the ion, even the ion section. Where is that? Show me where that is, then. So they're two different things. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
And since our eyes operate at optical frequencies, and we know that that's like 10 to the 14th hertz, very high frequency, and our eyes operate across roughly 400 to 700 millimicrons, 400 to 700 nanometers, used to be called millimicrons, a little bit less than one octave, between 100 megacycles and violet. I just did a calculation. 100 megacycles RF and violet light, there's 23 and a quarter octaves, and our eyes operate across less than one of those octaves. There's an awful lot that we don't see. You talk to a person who's had a cataract operation where he's replaced the lens of the eye with some other material, and all of a sudden their eye starts responding to ultraviolet like it never has, and they start seeing things they've never seen before. Or you build one of these ultrasonic detectors when you can hear bats that are running at 40 kilohertz, and you translate that down to audio frequencies. There's a whole lot of sounds that your cats and dogs have been listening to that you've never heard. You just jingle your keys in front of a ultrasonic detector, and you'd be amazed how much ultrasonic noise you're making. Or you operate a spray can. Let me drop. Spray paint is really an ultrasonic whistle. So there's a lot that we're not hearing, there's a lot that we're not seeing, a lot that we're not sensing. One of the things that worries me a little bit about James Webb is that a million miles away from Earth, there is absolutely no repair capability, unless you build the world's best robot that can go out there. And even getting that there would be an extremely difficult project. We've now gone through, four or five major repairs of Hubble, where we replace batteries, replace computers, replace gyros, replace inertial wheels, replace a lot of things. Yes, Hubble runs on something like 2,800 watts that has to be continuously supplied. And so every 24-hour day, every hour and three-quarters, hour and a half, Hubble is going behind the Earth, being shadowed. It's not getting solar power on it with solar cells, and therefore it's got to run on its batteries. So it's using battery power, 5-6 times every single day, and therefore those batteries are really being exercised. In the case of James Webb, there's nowhere near as many of those cycles, but still, at that Lagrange point where it's going to be a million miles away from Earth, on the opposite side of the Earth as the Sun, and therefore to some degree, I guess the Earth is a shadow to it. That's four times the distance to the Moon. And how long is James Webb going to be in the shadow of the Earth, I don't know. So, but at least the batteries will be exercised a lot less. However, you and I would like James Webb to last for 15 years. I don't know of a rechargeable battery technology that has anywhere near that kind of life. The gyros on Hubble are replaced every 3, 4, 5 years. So are there gyros that have enough life? Are there batteries that have enough life? on a major satellite that has no repair capability. That's a little bit troublesome. I wonder if that has been approached on any of the articles you've read, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, you've got rechargeable batteries that, you know, I mean, even these RTGs, radioisotope thermal generators, they can generate power and they'll charge batteries. And these things, I guess, go on for decades, I would think. Like the Voyager, well, I would think that those things still have batteries on board. Or is it just being generated and plugged directly into the system with big capacitors? I don't know, I guess. But yeah, they plan on running this thing. There are solar panels. You can see the solar panels when you look at the... they're not all that big. And I'm surprised that the solar panels aren't all that big. James Webb. And it'll be in the... they want to keep it away from the Earth because of the heat, the infrared reaction from the Earth, not so much to keep it in the shadow of the Earth. In fact, most of the times it won't be. And that's why it's got this gigantic shade. If you look at the James Webb, the 21-foot mirror is being shaded by this gigantic, you know, huge blankets that are going to be unfurled, probably the size of a tennis court. I'm dropping it. And that's what's going to keep everything cold and in the dark for the mirror part of it and the detectors. But the, you know, the craft itself will probably, you know, see the sun quite a bit. In fact, they go into what they call a halo orbit. It kind of like stays at that Lagrange point too, a million miles away from Earth. But it moves around a lot out there. It does have fuel on board. And it will adjust itself now and then. So, and you've got the Herschel Space Telescope out there right now. I think Planck is out there. And these things that are being built the same way, they have no way to get out there to repair them. The gyros, we've talked about that. They don't have the standard gyros that Hubble and some of the older spacecraft had. And they have, let me drop it. WS2N for ID. They have hemispherical resonator gyros. We talked about these things. They only weigh a pound. That's all they weigh. They don't spin. They vibrate. Quartz detectors pick up the vibrations of this thing as it moves in space, as it rotates. You know, the detectors can pick up where it's located. On all three axes. So, you know, they've solved that problem. These things are 99.9%. They won't break. They've used them on Cassini. They've used them on Eros, the one that landed on the Nia spacecraft that landed on the asteroid Eros. They've used them on, the Genesis spacecraft that went out on the comets. They used it on Stardust. It's been used maybe 100 different times without failure. Guaranteed to outlast any spacecraft, including James Webb. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, the gyros have been solved. The solar cells. I don't think there's any nuclear generators on James Webb. I think it's all solar power. Let's assume it's going to get rather continuous solar power. It doesn't need the battery storage very much. But what does the positioning? Are there inertial wheels? And by the way, as far as cryogenics for the infrared detector is concerned, is that going to be running on liquid helium, a finite amount of liquid helium for the infrared detection? So my last two questions are, where is the cryogenic cooling coming from? And maybe it's being done passively. When you're really far enough away from the Earth, all you got to do is aim a feed horn into the cold sky, and you've got 3 degrees Kelvin, if you know what I mean. You don't need liquid helium. So maybe a consumable is not being used. I don't know that one yet. Maybe you do. And when I decide to steer James Webb to some other location, what do I push against? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, they do have momentum gyros to move, you know, flight slight movements here or there. But they also got, you know, a couple thousand pounds of hydrazine fuel on board, too. So this stuff, you know, was very fine thrusters, and they do have that on board. You know, you don't need a spark plug for this stuff. When it goes into the chamber, you know, it just ignites. So they do have that. And that's really going to determine the life of the vehicle. You know, when they run out of that fuel and they're unable to make, you know, important big changes that they need to make. But they're expecting 10 years out of this thing, minimum. So 2018 to 1028. And so yeah, you've got momentum wheels for fine adjustments. You've got the mirror is not like Hubble. When you point it at this deep field or whatever it is, you're pointing exactly in one spot, looking for Pluto or Pluto's moons or whatever. The whole telescope has to be adjusted. They've got momentum wheels on that thing too, and huge spinning gyros. Everything's got to work. With James Webb, you get it kind of close, and then you just, you know, hit a button, and, well, you don't hit a button, but, you know, it'll turn itself. The mirror will rotate. It's really an agile situation, but it will turn. So you don't have to worry about wear and tear on all these moving, spinning things to readjust it every time you want to make a different shot.
Sounds awful good. I'm a little disappointed it's going to be 2018. That's, what, 7 more years from now, if there's no further delays. Okay. Keep tracking those spacecraft, Paul. Glad to hear all this good news from NASA. Let's hope their funding continues. John was the next person who had a real question. KC2WGB. Hope we haven't put you to sleep, John. And what would you like to discuss tonight? K2RIW and the TechNet.
No, I don't sleep during the TechNet, that's for sure. It's always interesting. If I may, Dick, I'd like to digress for your opinion on that self-control.
That's a good subject. Lots of people are interested. Go for it, John.
Okay, Dick, this has more to do with the people of Fayetteville that are promulgating this doctrine. It behooves me to understand when you are trying to represent your case and purposely remove exculpatory evidence, that is not good, at least from my viewpoint, and I was interested in yours, because they're not being honest. This system was tried before by unscrupulous people when they burnt their Reichstag. What are they trying to accomplish? And I think it diminishes their position. I just wanted to see what you thought about that.
You're absolutely right. Because they haven't presented a objective viewpoint on their main website that's been there now for 3 or 4 years, it's a pretty looking website, lots and lots of data, but all of the data is in one direction only. Somehow, after I made my presentation before the village board a couple of years ago, and my relatives in the town found out about it a week later and disowned me, disfellowshipped me, or shunned me. I don't exist anymore. I died in their mind. I'm no longer invited to holiday gathers anymore. They won't come to my house. They won't let me go to their house. Their opinion is that strong. The natives that I talked to after the presentation before the zoning board, before the town board, let me drop. I could tell that the residents of the town know that they sense that they have a very uphill battle. They're fighting a lot of government agencies simultaneously, federal, state, local, whatever. And therefore, they believe their case needs so darn much defense that they've got 3 attorneys running in parallel on 3 separate lawsuits. And from their point of view, they've got a difficult enough case just presenting their case, and that's all they've done is to present their case. The fact that they're against it, and everything they can find that's against it, and anything that's for it, the safety factors and the lack of evidence that it really creates a health hazard, They're not willing to present that. They know that that data already exists. But you're absolutely right. If only the data that's on the Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers, the BRACT website, if that was the only data being presented in court, and no other data was being presented, well, you could say the attorney for the plaintiff would be presenting that data, and then the rest of the world would present their data. So maybe that's one way of looking at it. They are supplying the data for their plaintiff attorney, and the opposing attorney, they don't think they've got to supply that data. They know that it exists. They know that there's a lot of opposing data. They're lying to say that. So, unusual situation. It's the most extreme case that I know of on Long Island, but it's not the only one. There are a number of other communities that have attitudes that are not quite that strong, but in that direction. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, it just seems to be, actually it appears to be criminal to me, and at the least it's very disingenuous. The fact that the website was up and that they removed it is what I'm questioning. It appears that great. I understand that the courtroom procedure would be a little different, but the credibility is falling away as soon as I see something like that, because if their information can hold water, why remove either a pro or a con? But, okay, I was just interested in your opinion, but it's really a serious thing that's going on. And by the way, they've taken a new tack. I don't know if you've been following this part of it, but it's not so much the cell phone radiation now. The European study is questioning cell phone.
Now, let's back up a little bit now. I've created a little bit of a confusion, John. The cell site, the site called Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers, that site still exists. The town, the village site, used to give you pro and con information. In other words, the federal documents you could go to, and the park we call it, PASC, is the name of an organization that they hired to do a survey in the town, to bring good laboratory instrumentation to the town and make measurements. And that's approximately a 30 or 50 page report. That report used to be on the village website, and the whole situation was on the village website. But the village website has removed all data on the subject. But the residents have the cell site, have the website called Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. That one still exists. And all of the evidence for the job. You got the American National Standards Institute, ANSI, a division of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineering, who has for 60 solid years been studying the potential biohazards of radio energy. 60 years. You go to that particular C95 report, which is the defining document for the United States, for the Department of Defense, for NIOSH, for OSHA. It is the defining document for the United States. That document contains over 1,000 references of your best institutions and experimental laboratories and colleges and whatever, universities. All the best data on that subject, including a number of foreign references, are there. The Bureau of Radiological Health for the United Kingdom has a similar document with similar references. And their study has also gone on for 55 or 60 years. Germany has a similar document. Japan has a similar document. I think the Australian document is probably a subset of the one from the United Kingdom, from the one from England, and so on. All these documents come up to very similar conclusions. And the conclusion is, for 60 solid years, we've been looking for the non-thermal effect. They haven't found anything but the thermal effect. Want to drop? So, it's very easy to jump to the conclusion that the nerves in your body are like transmission lines, that there's an electrical signal going down that transmission line, that a burst of RF energy hitting that transmission line could possibly be rectified, create a phony signal that goes down that transmission line. Well, they've been looking for that effect and can't find it. Turns out your nerves are not electrical, they are chemical. The RF energy hitting your body creates heating. No other known effect other than heating has really been detected and verified in a second laboratory. So once you accept heating effect, and once you accept a 6-minute thermal time constant of most of the organs of your body, including the one with the shortest time constant and the greatest sensitivity, your human eye. Once you accept the thermal time constant of 6 minutes, and you're talking about pulsing rates at either 1,000 or 1,000,000 pulses per second, it is the average energy of those pulses that creates the heating, that creates the effect, if there's an effect. The fact that it's pulse energy, and the energy is not being detected as a voltage in any way that has been verified to date. There's no magic about pulses versus real energy. Now, the one place where pulse energy has been detected, let me drop, is the so-called acoustic effect that has been determined with reference to high-power radars. A real genius of a guy named Eugene Frubini, who used to be one of the top engineers at a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory. In 1956, he put his head in front of the feed horn of an FPS-20 radar, an L-band megawatt radar. He put his head in the front of that feed horn for probably something like 10 or 15 seconds. And what did he hear? He heard a buzzing sound in his head equal to the rep rate of the radar. The so-called acoustic effect of radar exposure, high-power radar exposure, was recognized for quite a number of years, and they finally figured out what it was somewhere around 1990 or so, 1995. I think it was University of Northern Carolina or South Carolina that made the discovery by doing the same experiment with cats, dogs, and humans, mostly cats and dogs. And they discovered that when you got a really high-power radar, that's putting out a megawatt during each pulse, but the pulses are, you know, a 0.1% duty factor, 1,000 to 1. A megawatt of power, but a kilowatt of average, so to speak, and you're doing it for a few seconds to an animal. Turns out that the brain has a rather large thermal time constant, or a rather large thermal expansion coefficient, brain material. That's the reason why you've got these empty sections of the head, these ventricles, I guess they're called, to accommodate the expansion. That's why one of the reasons why the body tries to maintain a temperature very close to 98.6. And you can easily, with higher temperatures, run into excessive cranial temperature. Each individual pulse, looking at the human head as a kind of a crystal ball, so to speak, let me drop. That round dielectric blob that is a human brain and head does have a kind of a focusing effect, as if it was a very large marble, so to speak. And so the RF energy hitting the outside does get focused in the center of the brain. The center of the brain on each individual pulse gets thermally raised in temperature by something like a 0.01 or 0.1 degree Fahrenheit on each individual pulse. The expansion of the great thermal expansion coefficient, the thermal expansion coefficient of the brain, when it gets this pulse of energy that creates a measurable amount of heating, it creates a P wave, a wave that spreads outward from the center. It reflects off the cranium and comes back in as a reflected wave, and the hearing system is inside of that cranium. So you're hearing an acoustic effect caused by pulses of thermal expansion. And yes, those pulses are giving you a measurable effect on the human being, but it takes megawatt pulses to do it. Your cell phone running milliwatts, not a chance in the world by my standards. KC2WGV, K2RIW.
You can see why we're coming.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel. And by the way, Eugene Frubini, when he did this experiment, he reported it on the front cover of the AIL monthly magazine, which is called the AIL Record. And that's a classic issue, because he went on to work for the Department of Defense at a very high position in Washington 10 or so years later. Over to you, Mel.
I was wondering if you were familiar with the lawsuit and the findings of the DEW report, over.
I guess you ought to tell me about it. By the way, throughout history, in the United States, France, and a number of other places, there have been some spurious, I'm going to call them, spurious lawsuits, where the evidence presented and the judges recognizing the fact that they don't really have all the the information, can't easily make a decision, but some crazy decisions have been made, like the ones that did take place in Lyon, France, where a cell site was ordered to be removed because all the people in the local apartment building were suffering all kinds of health effects, and they were really miserable. And the people who were ordered to remove the cell site said, this is crazy. We hadn't even installed the antennas yet. This wasn't operational. Over to you, Mel. KQRIW.
Okay, way back, there was a thing called the DEW system up there, I guess, in northern Canada. And a number of the people that worked up there, especially in front of the antenna, doing regular maintenance, seems like a high percentage of them passed away from, at that time, whatever, they could diagnose as some form of a cancer or whatever. Died, they said, at a much younger age than the average, and a number of other things. And there was a lawsuit brought by, I believe, their relatives, wives, whatever, mothers, fathers, whatever it was. And I was wondering, whatever happened to that study, and whatever happened to the, did it ever go to court over?
When you called the DEW case, I didn't recognize it. I always knew that as the DEW line. DEW stands for Distant Early Warning. The DEW line equipment, which eventually was replaced by the BMUSE, Ballistic Missile Early Warning System. So DEW line became BMUSE, and DEW line people, it was very well known that they were up there in this far northern Arctic area where it gets extremely cold, numbers like minus 40 and minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit on many, many days. And those people used to stand in front of the antenna in order to warm their body. And that was an extremely high-power radar. And they were standing in front of it for, I think, a good fraction of an hour at times. So even if bodily injury could be confirmed in that case, those people had intentionally exposed themselves as a method of warming their body. And they used to make a lot of jokes about the fact that, hey, this high-power radar, the main thing it's doing for us is warming the people that have to work on the thing and maintain it. So because of the exposure that they intentionally created for themselves, and because of the power level of that radar, that's a very unusual case. Your local cell site and cell phone can't come within a million to one of doing that, if you know what I mean. No, I didn't hear what happened to those lawsuits, Mel. First of all, how well documented do you know of were there really lawsuits? It's not just an urban legend. Were there really lawsuits that were taken seriously? And how do you know that? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Going to go back a lot of years, of course. If you have to say the DEW was the original, DEW line was the original, KDIDEW and all. But I remember distinctly a case when I worked somewhere. Yeah, I think somebody showed me an article that was in the New York Times, oh, way, way back. And it said, see, the stuff is dangerous. I remember seeing something. I think, going to go back in how far, I believe I worked that time with Motorola or Zenith at that time. So I'm talking about a lot of years ago, and I never followed up, but I remember the article basically said that there was going to be some legal action taken over.
Comment, please.
You got it, John.
Dick, I don't remember what the frequency of the DEW line was, but shouldn't that have shown up massive cataract problems before they would develop cancer of the body?
I'm with you on that one. When it comes to RF exposure, it's rather well documented. The most sensitive, the most vulnerable part of the body is the human eye. The second most sensitive part is the reproductive organs. And now, for RF energy, which is known to create only thermal heating, nothing else has been really confirmed at reasonable power levels. Oh, yeah. If I put myself in front of a gigawatt radar and I'm arcing over the air and creating ozone and doing that inside the body, yeah, I can do, with really super high power pulses, I can do some funny things that are almost non-thermal, almost chemical. But at reasonable power levels, where all the energy is only thermal, can that thermal energy induce a cancer? And can you give enough thermal energy to an organ when you're doing whole body exposure, as the U-line was. They were operating at frequencies like L sub T band, which really is around 460 megacycles in that neighborhood. It was an over-the-horizon radar, long-range, over-the-horizon, distant early warning radar. In other words, any missile coming over that horizon, that was the shortest distance from Moscow to the United States, so to speak, would be over the North Pole. And that thing primarily looked over the North Pole to see if anything was coming over. So at those frequencies, you don't have very high focusing capability. You're talking about a 2-foot wavelength. So can that focus on your kidney versus your stomach? Not a chance. And can that thermal heating, with that broad a thermal effect, create a cancer? Wow. To create enough heating that you disturb cellular mitosis without cooking the human being and bringing his body temperature above 106 degrees Fahrenheit, where he goes into a convulsion, to do that is a darn good trick. So confirming that the cancer has that as a causative agent, that's a very difficult one to prove. And you can see where I'm going on that one, John.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can see where I'm going on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yeah, I had heard of that situation. I never knew what came to, if it ever went to court or not. But I would have thought that the eyes would have been damaged. There would have been cases of cataracts and cloudiness and things like that before it would have done anything else. I agree with you, Dick.
Okay, I think we've almost covered that one. Unless Mel had something else, because then we're going to go to John's real question. Back to you, Mel, if you had anything else you wanted to comment on the dew line situation.
Oh, I just recalled some of it about the dew line, and I remember some. In fact, I remember they circulated with people that were, they were contractors that were looking for people that wanted to work. Pay was very good and all, but there was a lot of work, a lot of talk around at that time. It's a very dangerous place to go to. That's why they're going to pay those salaries. I don't know, you know, what they were alluding to, whether it was working around the high-powered radar, that it was the weather conditions, or whatever. But I can just recall little bits of it, Dick, over.
By the time you train the people to do the work that you desire, by the time you ship them by who knows how many airlines, boats, buses and everything else to get them way up there into the northern area of Canada. We're talking about the uninhabited area. By the time you get them there, you want them to stay for 18 months. So I think those people had to sign up for either 1 year or 18 months because it was such an unusual environment, so far, far away from home with unusual training and living under what you and I would consider very adverse conditions. I think all of that is the main reason you had to pay top dollar, otherwise you didn't get people. It isn't necessarily because it's dangerous. There's a huge danger there of being frozen to death if you did something silly. There's that kind of danger. And if you were foolish enough to stand for a half hour, an hour of time in front of the antenna to warm yourself up, as opposed to buying the right kind of clothing, or using the right kind of clothing, that's another silly thing to do. So yeah, there's all kinds of hidden dangers of falling into a crevasse or whatever, or having the dogs attack you through a dog sled. So there's a whole lot of reasons why they had to pay a lot of money. And as such, in your organization, people could easily come up with an urban legend saying that the reason they're paying is because it's so dangerous, radio-wise dangerous. It's easy to come up with that as a theory. It might not have been accurate, Mel. Over to you for any other comment on that one, Mel, before we go over to John's real question. K2KEY, K2RAW.
No, not necessary. I could say so long ago that I only remember 50 pieces about it. I could say the environment, those guys, people that were really, many of them, I guess, working maybe in front of the antenna with maintenance, cleaning, I don't know, snow or whatever they were doing, you know, in front of that, and whether they were being, you know, thinking that, like you say, it was a relief from the cold, or that they enjoyed standing in front of the antenna intentionally, or where they were ordered to do that, I don't know. I don't remember the circumstances, Dick. It's too long ago. I was just recalling, you know, little bits and pieces about RF exposure. Okay, with that, I'll say goodnight to you. This is KTKEY. Talk to you next week. Take care.
Hi, Brian Mel, and be well. And by the way, those antennas, they were individual antennas, billboards, 120 feet high, parabolic in shape, probably 150 or so feet wide. And each one of those antennas created a particular beam aimed at a particular location. I think in some cases there was more than one feed horn where you could switch the feed horns in order to steer the beam a little bit. But these were really big antennas. And a guy I know who is a member of SARA, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, when the dew line was taken apart and no longer used, he literally purchased one of those antennas, used it as a radio telescope, and did some real nice work with that, this particular SARA member. I remember talking to him. I remember talking to his family. His family was very unhappy about the fact that he's living under these extremely severe conditions up north where he can easily starve to death, freeze to death, and so on, in order to do this very dedicated work of radio astronomy. And eventually he lost his funding, lost the ability to make the payments on the antenna that he had bought, and he had to eventually abandon the project. But that was a dedicated individual, a guy who literally lived in southern Canada, and for about a year and a half of his life lived in the territories, as he called it, way far up north in Canada, to man this operation. And the town that he was living near only had a very small number of residents. Let me drop this. And I think those were what you and I would call native Eskimo people were in that town, and a few of them. So, unusual situation. Okay, that was your quickie question on cell phones. What was the real question, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, maybe you can help me out with this. I have approximately 7 receivers, all bands open. I'm looking to have a way of operating all of them at the same time. They're all on individual antennas. But I want to be able to either disconnect the antennas or ground the antennas as soon as I transmit on one of my transceivers. These are only receivers I'm talking about, 7 of them. Maybe there's something made OEM, I don't know, but what could I do to facilitate that?
Let me first find out why you believe you need to do that, John. You've got 7 receivers connected to 7 antennas, and if you transmit on any one of the antennas, you want to ground all the others, the other 6, so to speak. Are you doing that to protect the low noise front end? Are you trying to avoid receiver overload? Do you believe it's going to create damage? If you have a reasonable separation between the antennas, and you can easily, with your test equipment, with a signal generator, you can measure the number of decibels of isolation between each antenna and each of the other antennas. If you pour a signal into antenna number 1 and measure how much signal comes out of antenna number 2, and it's 30 decibels weaker, then unless you're running megawatts of power, you're not likely to put enough power into antenna number 1 that will damage the equipment that's connected to antenna number 2. Lots and lots of people worry about this, but when you go and make a real measurement, the real amount of isolation in decibels may be a lot more than you anticipated, and even if it's not, making a minor arrangement of the physical layout of the antennas and or adding a filter to the appropriate antenna could make the problem go away, and no switching is required. So I'm wondering why you think you need it, John. Over to you, K2RIW.
I can comment on that.
No.
Go ahead, Mel.
In the days, one reason or another, I thought the more ham equipment you had, the better. And I loaded up. I've still got more than unbelievable most people have. And I, at the time, had a number of receivers. When the days of, you had separate transmitters and receivers, and I'd like to jump from one set up to another and all that. And on the receivers, to protect, that's what I was thinking, I had a bunch of Dow T relays. So that anytime anything went into transmit, it flipped to one main relay, which clicked all the Dow T relays into the, disconnected the antenna system from all the receivers, by Dow T relay stick, over.
But, did you think that you really needed to do that to protect the front end? Did you did you believe that the amount of coupling from antenna 1 to antenna 2 would be so great that when you transmitted with antenna 1, the power received by antenna number 2 would damage that radio? And even if you think that that radio would be damaged, because maybe it has a gallium arsenide field effect transistor front end, if you take a look at the schematic diagram that's on the automatic switching preamplifier made by Advanced Receiver Research, the 2-meter version and the 432 version and 220 version, there's a pair of Schottky diodes back-to-back on right across the input transistor from base to ground. So when signals are at a normal magnitude where they don't even turn on the diodes, you don't know the diodes are there. But at the first instant you turn on the transmitter, a whopping big signal comes down until that circuit inside the preamplifier senses the fact the transmitter is there, rectifies some of the RF energy, that biases a transistor that energizes the relay and puts it into the transmit bypass mode. But you start off transmitting into the back end of that preamplifier because it's in line to the antenna, and a simple pair of Schottkys can protect. So do you believe you needed that protection, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
No, I don't know. First of all, this is all poop technology. I was worried about those Collins receivers being damaged. So, like I say, you know, this is just conjecture on my part. It was suggested by Collins and, you know, or whatever, whoever suggested it. There was articles and everything in QST at the time and whatever. But I think it was, I guess it was just generally accepted that way, Dick. And I could say you'll damage, well, the only thing you damage would be the coil, you know, the front-end coil and the receiver. Maybe you pumped RF into it. You could, but I did once pry one of those coils in the Collins receiver. And I think I inadvertently did connect it directly to the transmitting antenna at the time, the same thing. But that's how it was done, with Dowkey relays. I don't know if this is good for John or not. Just came to my mind, over.
Yeah, if I transmitted 10 watts of power into the front end of a Collins receiver, I think I could damage that front end coil and give a lot of grief to that first grid of that first tube. But it would take something like 10 watts to do it. And if you're running 100 watts out of the other antenna, the only way your 100 watts would give you 10 watts into the Collins receiver would be if there's only 10 decibels of isolation between the two antennas. If I had two 80-meter dipoles parallel to each other, 2 feet apart, exact same altitude, parallel to each other, common sense would lead you to believe 132 feet of wire parallel, 2 feet apart. You would assume the signal coupling between the two would be unity. Do that experiment, and I've done it. I'll admit I did it at 900 megacycles, not at 3 megacycles, but I think the effect is the same. It scales. And you get 3.5 dB of loss no matter what you do. You try to choose the distance between two parallel dipoles so that you get maximum coupling without detuning. And you have to really work hard to get the insertion loss between the two below 3.5 dB. Any reasonable layout of antennas on your property is not going to have anywhere near that amount of coupling, though. Is it a slim possibility that because of miswiring of relays or whatever, that for a brief period of time, a transmitter through a coax cable was directly connected to that receiver front end? Is that possible, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
These are more, this is 100-watt rig, these are kilowatt-plus rig, you know, and the old tube amp. I don't know, Dick. I was just, like I say, it was a long, long time ago, and that was my simple solution. Well, it was the solution that was said, if you looked in the old handbook, you looked in QST articles and everything, you'll remember the Dowkey relays. They were very popular. So they were used for so many different purposes. They were popular, they were cheap, and everything, and, better safe than sorry was the word, over.
I'm going to agree with you. What you did was good belt and suspenders, super conservative protection of that Collins receiver. But if you really measured with laboratory equipment, with a signal generator and some kind of a power detector, what is the true isolation between all of your antennas? With rare exceptions, you're going to be amazed at how high the isolation is. to radiate a signal into space, it's going into all 4 pi star radius. It's going into all 41,000 square degrees of space. And even though your eye says, boy, those antennas are close, if you looked at it with a radio eye and you realize what percentage of the power is being absorbed by the second antenna, and you pick a number 15 feet away from the first antenna, you'd be amazed what that isolation is. So I guess my first question before you go through all the effort, John, is that you got the equipment by which you could measure the number of decibels of isolation at all the frequencies you care about across all of those antenna combinations that you care about, and there's a good chance that you're going to be pleasantly surprised. You've got about 3 choices here. Take the relay approach you're considering. Put back-to-back diodes across the receivers. Measure the insertion noise. Consider using filtering. In other words, by various passive means, without going into active relay switching, I'm not convinced that you really need it. There may be one particular combination of transmitter and one of those 7 receivers where, yes, the total amount of power that can get there could possibly give you some grief. And can you eliminate it with a filter and back-to-back diodes is an interesting question. Do you really have to switch a relay? Because once you start putting relays in the system, guarantee that in the heat of battle of some particular day, you're going to want the relay to be in the signal transfer mode, and it won't be. That's going to take you a lot of troubleshooting to find out what went wrong. Are you sure you want to add all that complication? It might not be required. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, the only thing that struck a little fear in me is when I forget to turn the radios off and I'll hit a transmit key on one of the transmitters, the S meter's pinned. And that's what made me think of it. I'm saying that so I could be overloading these front ends. My antennas are only approximately, they're mostly vertical, they're about 10 feet apart. So that's what made me wonder, maybe I should put only on the receivers relays that drop out the antenna or ground the antennas when I'm transmitting with any of the transceivers. But that's a good point. I could make those measurements.
Yeah, when you see an S meter, a signal strength meter, get pegged, and it flies over there in a hurry, it can easily put the fear of God in you. But now if you look at it rationally, what's really going on? A good sensitive receiver is made to listen to a signal of roughly a microvolt or less when it comes to its ultimate sensitivity. There's 120 decibels of gain between that front end and that loudspeaker. That's a, let me think, 120 decibels, that's a million times a million. I think it's a giga gain, if you know what I mean. It's a hell of a lot of gain. Tremendous amount of gain. However, all of that gain is made for signals that have a dynamic range between noise level and the strongest signal that you're supposed to respond correctly. Rarely does a receiver have more than 90 decibels of instantaneous dynamic range, including its automatic gain control function. Rarely does a receiver go above 90 dB of dynamic range. And you've got 120 decibels of gain between that front end and the loudspeaker. So therefore, without a doubt, you can, radio-wise, as far as linear reception is concerned, you can overload the living daylights out of that receiver very easily with anything that goes on in the shack that's beyond the milliwatt level. However, the circuitry that's driving that signal strength meter, there's a particular transistor that has the function of driving the signal strength meter. That transistor with its resistors and capacitive coupling and whatever is sized in order to have enough current capability to drive that meter. And maybe twice the, if the meter requires a milliamp, maybe that circuit can supply 2 milliamps. But that circuit doesn't have enough hair on its chest to drive that meter to the point where it can damage it. Yeah, the meter's going to move over in real fast, and it's going to scare the daylights out of it.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
But the way the circuitry in that receiver is designed, you can't damage the meter, you can't damage the loudspeaker, you can't damage anything else in there. As long as you haven't poured, let me pick a number, more than a watt of power into the front end. If you're running 100 watts of transmitter power, and it takes a watt to come to the threshold of damaging the front end, the difference between the two is 20 decibels. If you can confirm that you've got 20 decibels of isolation at the frequency of interest between the antenna number 1 and antenna number 2, and you probably have 35 dB of isolation when you go and measure it. Anything more than 20 is gravy, as far as creating damage is concerned. And even if you do calculate, you come up to the 1 watt level, you can protect it with